Renegade Broadcasting, hard-hitting talk radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Firestarter Radio. This is Sinead. So, first, I wanted to talk about my favorite Nordic Knots Bowls. What are they even called? The Nordfront, Nordic Resistance, I don't even know. Now look, I've done shows on them in the past. There are obviously good-intentioned, well-meaning people that are caught up in this mess, right? However, I don't see any of them holding their leadership accountable and asking them questions like, I don't know, why we're a national socialist group training with Russian imperialist militias? You know, maybe someone would like to answer that question, but I haven't really seen much about any of their leadership being questioned, them being taken to task or held accountable for these decisions that seem to work directly against National Socialism. Imperialists and National Socialists are on way opposite sides of the spectrum here, so I don't quite understand why they would be working together, let alone training, military training. Anyways, someone had posted this in one of the comment sections. I think it was on the whole Alain Soral thing, which maybe I'll get into that in a little bit in case people haven't seen it. I covered a lot Alain Soral back, you know, I don't know. At some point in the years I've been doing shows, seems he is a Mason and just controlled opposition. But I'll get into why. And we actually have a French guy, I guess, who did a video about that. How this video is still up on YouTube, I don't know. I don't understand how this guy is able to have a functioning YouTube channel. I don't know, maybe because he's in France, but I don't know. That's cool. Jealous, bro. Okay. So this is from Nordfront's wonderful site, and it says, after being translated into more cosmopolitan languages such as English, and I used Google Translate, so it's not going to be perfect. The Nordic Resistance Movement's party program, Our Way, has finally been translated into a more relevant and honorable language, namely Russian. Oh, did you know that Russian is a more relevant and honorable language? Because Russia's taking over the world, but, you know. I mean, isn't that weird that they would say that? I mean, whatever. I'm not saying Russian is not a cool language. It's cool. I personally can't speak it. At all. I can't even pronounce the names. But why are these Nords so interested in Russia? And they're trying to make it look like they're influencing Russia and totally not the other way around. Russia influencing them, which is exactly what's going on. They are being led by Knots Bowls. I did a show called Nordic Knots Bowls or something like this. Just type in Nordic and Knots Bowl in Renegade Broadcasting search and you should find something. I did a pretty comprehensive show and if you look at the comments section, I mean, they really can't refute these things that we've brought up. And these things don't look good for a National Socialist group. I mean, having one of your guys wearing a revolution t-shirt, running into the middle of a tennis match, throwing up a Knots Bowl salute, not a Roman salute. No, a Knots Bowl salute. Now, their excuse for that is, well, it's illegal to do the Roman salute. So therefore, he did the Knots Bowl salute. Okay, is it not illegal to run onto a tennis court in the middle of a sporting match? Pretty sure that's illegal. So your dude was going to go to jail anyways, although he probably didn't go to jail because he's an agent of the government. But, you know, let's just take this at face value. He ran out into the court, did the Knots Bowl salute because the Roman salute's illegal. He still would have gone to jail. You can't just run into a sports event. I mean, that's not legal. You just can't do that pretty much everywhere. So why was he not worried about going to jail for running out into the middle of a match, but he was worried about, oh, I probably shouldn't do the Roman salute when I'm breaking the law here? I mean, come on. And why the revolution shirt? Come on. Sorry for noticing things here, but apparently noticing things and asking questions is fighting. Ugh, I'm just fighting. That's fine, because I'm not on the same team as you people. So yeah, I am fighting. I'm fighting against Knots Bowl infiltration. And not even infiltration, just straight up leading these white movements. They're leading them. And been trying to yell from the sidelines like, hey guys, turn around. turn around, you're headed off a cliff. Oh, there you go. You fell off the cliff. We tried to warn you. So, okay, let's read the rest of this. Okay, it says, the translation has been done in collaboration with leading Russian troll factories. What? And will probably lead to more effective Russian influence campaigns during the 2022 election campaign. Russian influence campaigns? Okay. Since then, in addition to Swedish and English, our way is also understood in Danish, Norwegian, and Finnish. Our road in Russian can either be downloaded as a PDF to read full below. I don't know. Maybe I'll look through this manifesto or whatever the heck it is and see if there's anything interesting. Okay, well, I guess it's saying that the document has been removed from Scribd, whatever this little website is that I guess uploads PDFs. So I guess I can't read it, but I mean, I can like scroll through here. However, it would take me forever to even be able to search words. So I don't know. But that's just interesting. But yeah, they just had on Eric Stryker recently on their podcast. What is this? Daily Stormer demonstrations in Sweden. Let's see what they're saying about this. I mean, they might as well be endorsing the Stormer. They've endorsed all the other Jewish-controlled opposition. Oh, it says Daily Stormer, celebrates the demonstration. Only Sweden and Greece have effective movements. So I guess they're happy that Daily Stormer is celebrating them. Oh, this is written by Andrew Anglin. So they're posting Andrew Anglin articles. Okay, that should be enough to just discredit this entire leadership. Obviously, there are good people that are caught up in it. But, I mean, these people are pieces of shit for endorsing something like this. And I remember this whole Paulina Forslund thing. I went out of my way, and many of you people that are still listening went out of your way, to help her family out when her husband was supposedly in jail. We raised several thousands of dollars for this family. She has like 20 kids or something, and her husband was in jail. And so, like, we all felt bad for her. And people donated money to her, and I, you know, made a video. I made sure that people knew about her story, and she was very thankful, and yes, but then I remember trying to hit us all up for money again because she wanted to throw a party for her husband when he got out of jail. Look, that's just rude to everybody that, you know, dug into their pockets when we all don't have much at all and gave whatever little spare change we could to this family for her to then try and hit us up for more money for a party. I found it extremely insulting, and it spoke a lot about her character that she would even feel like she could do such a thing. I mean, it just really disgusted me. You know, yeah, we'll donate if your children need to eat, but I don't think a party is necessarily a priority. Maybe use that money that you need for a party and pay your bills with that. I'm sorry, but that just disgusted me. So yeah, they're just posting Andrew Anglin's articles here. Let's see what he's bitching about feminists. While the movement to racially replace Europeans is adorned with feminists, white status seekers, and gays, it, as in the United States and everywhere in the Western world, is led by Jewish power. Yeah, Posting Andrew Anglin articles. Is that enough for you guys? I mean, I can keep going. It's just... This is retarded. And I'm getting triggered again because there are no frickin' standards at all in these movements. It's a joke. It is a joke. How hard is it to have standards? Like, maybe we shouldn't republish the person that calls for the rape, torture, and murder of white women on our National Socialist site. I don't know. But no, I'm glad they do, because now you can see that their leadership is completely kiked. Completely. Has been since day one. Simon Lindbergh. Oh, yeah, the great Nordic hero, Simon Lindbergh. They also had on Augustus Sol Invictus, you know, totally National Socialist guy. Not even freaking white. What the hell is that, dude? He's like a character from a play. He speaks with this weird accent like he's on stage. Like, it's an actor accent. It's ridiculous. Here, I'll play some for you. Okay, I guess he only does it for his speeches, and then he just speaks somewhat normally for his interviews. But yeah, I'll find an example for you. I'm just really glad, though, that Nordfront is interviewing a Thelemite, a Crowleyite. Yeah, that's really good. Okay, here you go. I'll play you Augustus in his ridiculous accent.
You seek to serve your countrymen as leaders, or do you haggle and haggle for power by debasing yourselves for a few votes more?
So deep.
You seek to protect the freedoms guaranteed by the revolution, or do you act as slaves to your parties and your lobbyists in order to secure more funding?
Secure more funding. I don't know. It's like a weird southern accent, but it's also not. I don't know what the hell it is. This dude's freaking demonic looking. Okay, so we've got this NS organization interviewing a non-white man with non-white children who's a Thelemite Crowleyite psycho. And gosh, I'm sorry, I'm just fighting again. I'm so sorry for fighting. Really? Really? Okay, I found an old article where they, you know, talk about Dugin on the Nordfront website. I don't think I ever covered this one in my Nordic Knotsballs show or Nordfront Knotsballs, whatever it was called. I'm just going to read it because it's quite interesting. Okay. The former people's governor in Donetsk, Pavel Gubarev, was taken to a hospital in Rostov near Don. Gubarev is unconscious with severe head injuries after the car he was driving in was hit and crashed into a post. The incident occurred in the area controlled by the rebels in the breakaway Republic of Donetsk. What the hell's going on over there? I have no idea. This is me now. Drew did a pretty good show summing up, like, what we can grasp. But I, you know, it's Jew versus Jew. I've got that figured out. But all the details, I don't know. Okay, so back to this. Unknown persons opened fire on the car in which Gubarev was traveling, resulting in the car pulling off the road and crashing into a post. Gubarev previously survived a murder trial in June this year when his apartment was fired with a rocket rifle. Pavel Gubarev was previously a member of the National Socialist Organization, Russian National Unity. Huh, gotta look into them. Which is led by the Russian nationalist Alexander Barkashov. Nowadays, he and his wife, Ekaterina Gubarev, are linked to Alexander Dugin's Eurasian movement. Gubarev also has contacts with a nationalist research movement in Russia that is trying to save the white race by countering our too low birth rates and high death rates by transferring white people's consciousness to electronically controlled bodies, so-called transhumanism? What? Okay, this article was written in 2014, by the way. It goes on. As the people's governor, Gubarev was in practice with the leader of the Donetsk Republic in the spring when the independent struggle was waged by Dugin-inspired activists occupying the Ukrainian coup regime's government buildings. In connection with this, he was kidnapped and abducted by the regime and eventually sentenced to a 2-year prison sentence. The leadership then passed to Denis Pushilin, who became the first official leader of the Donetsk Republic in connection with the battle going into a military phase. Gubarev was released in early May this year during an exchange of prisoners and returned immediately to Donetsk. However, the leadership of the breakaway republic was taken over by Igor Strelkov's old partner, Alexander Borodai. Strelkov and Borodai have previously worked together on a number of nationalist projects, including with the Jewish power critical journalist, communist, and radical national Alexander Prokhanov. Like, what? How can you be Jewish power critical journalist and a communist and radical nationalist? What? How can you even... Okay. Yeah, so this guy, Alexander Prokhanov, is apparently all of those things. According to Prokhanov, Bordai is a true white Russian nationalist. Bordai was later replaced as the leader of Donetsk Republic by Oplot's chief Alexander Zakharchenko in connection with the resignation of Strelkov from the post of Secretary of Defense. I gotta look more into these characters. This is confusing, but it seems like they're not speaking critically of any of these characters, like that they're true nationalists, nationalist communists. What? Critical of Jewish power, but a communist at the same time. No, that makes no sense at all. All right, it goes on. Gubarev has so far continued to work within the top management of the Donetsk Republic. He is the rebel leader who stood closest to Strelkov and is alongside Alexei Mozgovoy, one of the few who has openly shown support for Strelkov after his departure. The current situation is that Gubarev, Strelkov, and Dugin together constitute a radical and more warlike falcon within the rebel movement and strongly question the tactically correct nature of the negotiations with Ukrainian Jewish President Petro Poroshenko, formerly Valtsman. So I think I can see the narrative that's being spun here. It's like Dugin is cool. These commies are critical of Jews. I mean, Interesting. So I'm looking into this Russian national unity thing, and they use red. I mean, obviously, red is kind of like a Russian color, but also commie. And interesting, too, because these guys are using green flags as well when they're in Russia. And we know Nordfront's whole color scheme is green. It's just interesting. It says, Russian nationalists march on National Unity Day. Let's look into these guys a little bit more here. All right. So, yeah, according to this Nordfront article, these guys are like base national socialists. So let's look into this. Oh, religion, Russian Orthodoxy, Slavic neo-paganism. Okay. Far right. Anti-communism, neo-Nazism, Russian nationalism, anti-Semitism, blah, blah, blah. Okay, let's see here. Russian National Unity, or All Russian Civic Patriotic Movement, Russian National Unity, is a neo-Nazi political party and paramilitary organization based in Russia and formerly operating in states with Russian-speaking populations. It was founded by the ultra-nationalist Alexander Barkashov. Let's look into this guy a little bit more. All right, well, Wiki says that this Alexander Petrovich Barkashov is a Russian political leader and far-right nationalist who founded Russian National Unity, a neo-Nazi political party and paramilitary organization. Okay, this is interesting. Obviously, it's really hard to get a good grasp about what's going on over there because a lot of it is not in English, but I'm finding some things in English and I'm kind of piecing them together. So it seems to be like just your run-of-the-mill neo-Nazi controlled opposition that's going on over here with this group. So let's just read this little paragraph here. As part of the backlash against Yeltsin, Alexander Barkashov, a former member of Pamyat, an anti-Semitic organization which blames a Zionist Masonic plot, yes, it is a Jewish Masonic plot, for the Russian Revolution and for all of Russia's ills, and the founder and leader of neo-Nazi group Russian National Unity, that's, you know, the guy we've been talking about, allied with former KGB officer Alexander Sturgilov, himself an open anti-Semite. Yeah, it's like a Putin, right? Oh, Putin is so against the Jews. Yeah, and he was ex-KGB too. So, yeah, he allied with former KGB officer Alexander Sturgilov, himself an open anti-Semite, to form the Russian National Assembly, which wanted to remove Yeltsin through constitutional means and advocated the unification of all Slavs from the former USSR, and of which many members were active duty intelligence officers. Sturgilov explaining that the security organs were always composed of patriotically minded people. Sure they were. Let's read on. This process of unification of the opposition to Yeltsin culminated with the formation of the National Salvation Front, the alliance of the most hardline of Yeltsin's opponents composed of fascists, Russian ultranationalists, Tsarist monarchists, and Stalinists, which coalesced out of resentment at Russia's downfall from a major world power to a weak state plagued by instability and crises, and had close ties to a paramilitary bloc called Russian Unity. The co-chairman of the National Salvation Front was Alexander Prokhanov, who was also the editor-in-chief of Dien, the mouthpiece of the National Salvation Front, which published the vilest anti-Semitism, such as excerpts from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. That's their own words, but okay. And expressed support for Western neo-Nazis. Also involved in the National Salvation Front were Alexander Dugin, who was published in and helped edit Dien. Let's look into this. I think it's a magazine. And Edward Limonov. He's a communist faggot, by the way, Limonov. A former Russian exile who had been part of a punk and leftist who had been part of punk and leftist circles in the U.S., made Alain de Benoist in Paris. Alain de Benoist is big in the alt-kike. Covered him before. Maybe I'll get into it here. And participated in the Yugoslav War on the side of Radovan Karadzic before returning to Russia and joining the red-brown opposition to Yeltsin. Limonov was conscious that overt fascism had no means of succeeding in Russia because of the legacy of the Soviet Union's participation in the Second World War, and therefore he decided to attempt introducing it there through covert ways. This is a communist fag, by the way. And he and Dugin instead formed the National Bolshevik Front, which was itself part of the National Salvation Front and occupied a prominent position in the Russian counterculture. And now it's over here. Now it's our counterculture. Thank you, Dugin. Thank you, Jugin, and all the Jews that surround him. Thank you. How do you say thank you? Spasiba or something in Russian? I forget. All right. Another prominent member of the National Salvation Front was Gennady Zyuganov, who had previously taken part in discussions with Alain de Benoist and Jean-François Thiart during their visit to Russia in 91, and later founded the Communist Party of the Russian Federation, KPRF, which, despite its name, is an ultra-nationalist and reactionary organization. Weird. Isn't that weird? It's almost like these nationalist neo-Nazi people that we're all seeing around are actually just Bolsheviks, like, everywhere. It's crazy how they're morphing all of these things together. Now, just like, okay, I'm not saying that people with different beliefs and things can't work together for a common goal, right? Like, left and right coming together again. That's cool, right? But this is different. This isn't like communists and nationalists coming together. I mean, maybe at like lower levels, you're getting people to see, look, communism isn't the way, National Socialism is, and you bring them on over to your side, but I don't think two completely opposite camps can work together, especially when they're being led by Bolsheviks on both sides, okay? So it just doesn't work. All right, let's go on here. So yes, this Communist Party of the Russian Federation, KPRF, is an ultra-nationalist and reactionary organization which opposes cosmopolitanism. And remember how Nordfront, you know, scoffed at our cosmopolitan languages, right? We've translated it into English and other shitty, shitty languages, but now the noble and honorable Russian language will be there. I mean, yeah, okay, dude. They seem to really love them some Russia. And there's nothing wrong with loving Russia. They're white people. It's awesome. But their government, the mafia that controls their country and our countries, they're not on our side whatsoever. So that's what I have a problem with. Not the Russian people. They are my brothers and sisters, basically. We might sound a little different, speak a different language, but we're racial brothers and sisters in my eyes. Okay, yes. So this ultra-nationalist and reactionary organization opposes cosmopolitanism and claims Zionists are plotting to take over the world. Well, they're Jews, actually, and yeah, they are. They've done it pretty much. They're not plotting. They're now bragging about it. So it's called for blaming Jewish organizations in Russia together with fascist party Rodina. And I think we've covered Rodina before. Just get this tab open in case we need to go into it again. So, yes, they came together with Rodina in 2005, whose member, Albert Makashov, is an outspoken and virulent anti-Semite, a red-brown trend which is very common among many Stalinist parties of states which were once part of the former Soviet bloc. You know what? I'm just going to read on a little bit more about this because this is just interesting. I'm trying to get an idea about what the... Oh, it goes into Casa Pound. This is interesting. Maybe I should start at the beginning. Yeah. Let's just start at the beginning. So, yeah. And please correct me if any of this information is not correct. I'm just going to read it and we'll see what we find out. So, it starts with German National Bolshevism. The very first National Bolsheviks were Heinrich Laufenberg, a former member of the Social Democratic Party who had been president of the Council of the Workers and Soldiers in Hamburg during the German Revolution, and Fritz Wolfheim, an ex-member of the Industrial Workers of the World, who was then living in Hamburg and who were both leaders of the Hamburg branch of the Communist Party of Germany, KPD, during the 1910s. In 1919, they submitted to Karl Radek their policy of having the working class ally with the bourgeoisie into a nationalist dictatorship of the proletariat, which would fight a national liberation war, a position which would strangely be adopted by various Marxist, Leninist, and Maoist groups in the late 20th century against the Allies occupying Germany following World War I. Laufenberg and Wolfheim's proposal was rejected by Radek and labeled as an absurdity by Vladimir Lenin himself, and they were soon expelled from the KPD. Laufenberg and Wolfheim later helped the Communist Workers' Party of Germany, but were soon expelled from it as well because of their national Bolshevism, their expulsion being Radek's condition for admitting the KAPD to the Third Congress of Comintern. And that's what I would love to see for these Nordic Nordfront people. I wish they would throw Simon and his other shitty leaders, you know, out and you guys take over. I'm not saying that, like, oh, you got to get rid of this whole thing. No, your leadership is rotten. Please clean house. Get in there and clean out. Have a cleanse. Tabitha will show you how to do it, okay? You just got to go buy some enemas or something, or like some coffee, and I don't know the logistics of it, but you can just go ask her about that. Okay, so let's read on here. The French occupation of the Ruhr resulted in rising nationalism in Germany, especially among the working class, and threatened the Soviet Union's cooperation with Germany. Laid down in the Treaty of Rapallo in 1922 and the Soviet-German Military Pact, which allowed Germany to circumvent the limitations of it imposed by the Treaty of Versailles, and under which far-right German paramilitaries of the Schwarze Reichswehr were included, Fight Corps formations were permitted to train in Soviet territory and provide training for the newly created Red Army, and for Germany to give credits to the territory and provide training for... credits to the Soviet Union, while German firms were allowed to establish factories for the production of war equipment in Soviet territory. The Comintern subsequently pushed for cooperation between the communists and the ultra-nationalists. I think it's interesting, too, this ultra-nationalist term that's being used. It just kind of reminds me of ultra-violence. What was that, from A Clockwork Orange or something like that? MK Ultra. MK Ultra nationalists. That's pretty much what all these people are, because they are under severe mind control. And they're like, I'm a nationalist, though. I love Richard Spencer. I'm so different. I'm original. Okay. Radek gave a speech to the enlarged executive committee of the Comintern praising Leo Schlageder, a far-right Fight Corps member who, together with his unit, joined the NSDAP in 1921 and engaged in sabotage against the French forces occupying the Ruhr before being executed by them. Real quick, before I forget, this has nothing to do with this, but someone had left a good comment about, you know, I had read a comment from somebody else about how, you know, they were saying the Germans apparently used a Mischling as their, you know, idea of what a real German soldier should look like and be like. And apparently no one can actually find the proof of that. So I don't know if this commenter was just saying that. It did make me scratch my head, but it seems that nobody can find this actual magazine cover to prove that. So, you know, if I'm wrong, please share it. But yeah, we hear stuff like this all the time, and it's usually lies about, oh, the National Socialists did this and that. And I mean, look, it's good to be suspicious, but that, I haven't seen any proof for it. So I'd like to see some proof. But back to this. All right, so this is followed by a period of cooperation between the KPD and the Nazis against the Versailles Treaty, during which KPD member Ruth Fischer infamously attacked Jewish capital in an attempt to appeal to Nazi students. And the KPD's newspaper reprinted articles by members of the German far right, even as its rank and file members were fighting against fascists on the street. This second national Bolshevik wave died off during the period of growth Germany experienced from the mid to late 1920s. Though following the Comintern's social fascism turn itself, partly a reaction to the SPD using Freikorps units to crush the Spartacist uprising, during which revolutionaries Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht were murdered. The KPD cooperated again with the NSDAP in an attempt to bring down the Social Democratic Party-led government of Prussia in 1931, again with support from the Comintern, which wished to end diplomatic talks between France and Germany and participated in a strike together with the NSDAP in 1932. While again rank-and-file communists instead engaged in street battles against Nazi brown shirts, this strategy, also based on the flawed accelerationist idea that the fascists' policies would lead to a proletarian revolution, and summed by their leader of the KPD, Ernst Thälmann's slogan, "After Hitler, our turn," actively helped the rise of the Nazis in the KPD, refused to form a united front with the SPD and preferred directing its attacks against the Social Democrats even after the Nazis seized power and unleashed their violence on the German left. Their violence, like what? They broke some glass? Like, put people in camps where they're protected? Okay. The third period of National Bolshevism came with Ernst Niekisch, a former member of the SPD who was expelled for his extreme nationalism, after which he joined the old Social Democratic Party of Germany, which he pushed towards a more nationalistic direction and called for a Prussian Slavonic bloc from Visingen to Vladivostok. Niekisch saw the Russian Revolution as a national form of class struggle. He advocated for a nationalist form of communism. Sounds kind of like what's being promoted today and is being labeled as national socialist or nationalist, but it's nothing but communism. Nazbol, that's it. Okay, so yes, he advocated for a nationalistic form of communism and joined the Consortium of the Study of Soviet Planned Economy, which aimed to establish cooperation between Germany and the Soviet Union, which he saw as the only way of opposing the Treaty of Versailles. Niekisch was sentenced to life imprisonment by the Nazi regime in 1934 and was released after the Second World War, becoming an Orthodox Marxist and moving to West Germany following the suppression of the 1953 workers' uprising by the German Democratic Republic with Soviet support. Among those influenced by Niekisch was Otto Patel, who formed the group of Social Revolutionary Nationalists, which opposed the Versailles Treaty, supported close cooperation with the Soviet Union, and saw anti-capitalism as the means to free Germany and Western occupation. It sounds like seize the means of production bullshit. Unlike Niekisch, who was staunchly anti-Nazi, Patel attempted to work with the Hitler Youth, and many members of his organization also belonged to the left wing of the Nazi Party of Gregor and Otto Strasser, who were communists. That's where Strasserism comes from, and that is just Stalinist communism. That's it. Okay, let's get into Gregor and Otto Strasser. And Valian, her husband, Cody... Grody Cody. He was a big Strasserist. I didn't even know what it was. I was just like, yeah. And then when I finally started to learn about Knott's Bowls and everything, I'm like, oh my God, these freaking people have been commies from the start. I feel like an idiot. I feel like an idiot. Okay, so Strasserism was a form of national socialism advocated by the brothers Gregor and Otto Strasser. I'd say it's like a bastardization of it, but yeah. Both German veterans of the First World War, who later served in the Freikorps, which destroyed the socialist Bavarian Soviet Republic. Gregor took part in the Kapp-Putsch of 1920, which attempted to overthrow the Weimar Republic and replace it with a reactionary authoritarian state, while Otto joined the Social Democratic Party and opposed the coup. Both Gregor and Otto later joined Hitler's Nazi Party, and Gregor helping Hitler organize and grow the Nazi Party all across Germany. The Strasser brothers led a left-wing faction of the Nazi Party, which advocated for nationalizations and a mass action, worker-based and anti-capitalist, while still extremely anti-Semitic and anti-communist, which makes no sense because it's communist. Yeah, it was an anti-communist form of Nazism, with Otto interpreting Stalinism as a Russian form of national socialism and advocating for cooperation with the Soviet Union. Hitler's faction of the party instead sought to ally with industrialists, and this, as well as rivalry between Gregor Strasser and Hitler, led to clashes between the two. And during the Night of the Long Knives, which followed Hitler's rise to power, Gregor was killed and his faction of the Nazi Party was purged. Good. We need a purge here. I'm not saying go out and kill people. I'm just saying our movement needs a purge. We are being led by communists. And I hope that, you know, someone does clean house, especially with this Nordfront stuff. I mean, you guys, this is not a game, you know, and somebody's, who cares if people ostracize you and say you're fighting, you like someone needs to speak up, that your children's future depends on it. You have Jews leading your country and leading your nationalist movements, and you really think that they have a future? No, it should be normal people. And how do these people even get into leadership? Can anybody tell me this? I've asked so many times. How do these people, are they voted into leadership? I don't think so. I don't think like the dues paying members of Nordfront, all the people that pay to go to the little meetups, I don't think that they're voting for their leadership. Not saying voting is always the way, but like, does anybody question why Simon is the leader? What makes him fit to lead? Because he's a frickin' Knott's Bowl, I guess. All right. So yes, Gregor was killed, his faction of the Nazi Party was purged, and while Otto would form the Black Front after being expelled from the Nazi Party, the Black Front, right? It reminds me of all the black flags that these people were sharing, like Heathen Vegans Crew. Okay, so yes, they would form the Black Front after being expelled from the Nazi Party in 1930 and later went in exile before later returning to West Germany after the Second World War, where he remained active among neo-fascists. Something else that really pisses me off is people saying that fascism and National Socialism are the same thing. They're not. They are not the same thing. And people are just dumb. They just think it's cool to be like, I'm a fascist National Socialist. No, you're not. You're just, no. Okay, we're going to get into Yaki now. Francis Parker Yaki. As an anarchist researcher, Kevin Coogan details in his book, Francis Parker Yaki was born in Chicago, Illinois, in the United States, where he briefly flirted with Marxism in his youth, before soon abandoning it for fascism. He came under the influence of Carl Schmitt, Karl Haushofer, and Oswald Spengler, members of the German reactionary movement known as the Conservative Revolution, especially their ideas on culture elites, geopolitics, and support for anti-colonial struggles, something which together with many of its ideologues' support for an alliance between Germany and the Soviet Union, differentiated them from the positions of the Nazis, who instead preferred Western colonialism and white supremacist domination of the Third World. That's just ridiculous. The Germans wanted nothing to do with the Third World. What are they even talking about? Oh yeah, those Germans wanted to dominate the Third World so much. Okay, Yaki would later associate with fascists during the interwar period and during the Second World War, including Charles Coughlin, the German-American Bund, the National German-American Alliance, the Silver Shirts, the America First Movement, among others. During World War II, Yaki would enlist in the U.S. Army despite opposing the entry of the U.S. in the war. Disappearing for 2 months after pro-Nazi saboteurs with ties to his family were arrested by the FBI. The FBI suspected Yaki himself was on espionage mission for Nazis in Mexico. Before returning and being honorably discharged after a mental breakdown in 1943. Yaki soon applied for a post at the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, which was the original CIA, if you didn't know that. Yes, so he applied for a post at the OSS, but was refused a job there because of his Nazi sympathies. Or was he refused a job? Okay, the defeat of the Nazi regime did not weaken Yaki's commitment to fascism. Again, like, the Nazi regime wasn't fascist. Whatever. And he instead became more active in pro-fascist activity, becoming dedicated solely to reviving fascism. However, many of these groups were anti-communist and therefore would refuse to work with Yaki. With George Lincoln Rockwell of the American Nazi Party and his allies spurring Yaki and calling him a neo-Strasserist due to the idea of an alliance between the left and the right and working with anti-Zionist communists being central to Yaki's ideas. In 1946, Yaki obtained a position in the U.S. War Department as attorney for the Nuremberg trials. Wow, I didn't know that. Undoubtedly to help some of the Nazi war criminals being tried. Yeah, right. In German, Yaki would spend his time forming ties with German fascists operating underground against the Allies and agitating against the U.S. occupation of Germany and against what he perceived to be biased procedures of the trials, causing him to be fired from his position the next year. Following this, he fled to a small village in Ireland, where he wrote his heavily Spengler-influenced book, Imperium, with the aim of reviving fascism. In Imperium, he rejects the biological racism of the Nazis and opts for a cultural racism instead. I love that, biological racism. That's great. I mean, I guess in its definition, right, racism, like categorizing people into races. Yeah, we are biologically different. Yeah, that's just funny. Yeah, so he's more of a cultural racist, and that's why he's a fascist, because fascism isn't about race, as far as I understand it, whereas National Socialism is. Okay, so yeah, he opts for cultural racism instead, though he still defended the Nazis by denying the Holocaust in his book, which privately acknowledging the existence of the Holocaust and praising the Nazis' atrocities. That's great. So he's like, yeah, we did kill them all. Which he dedicated to Hitler, I guess, this book, being one of the very first Holocaust deniers ever, and considered the rise of the Nazi regime as the European Revolution. Yaki, being an avowed anti-Semite, the crux of the ideology laid out by this book was that Europe was being eroded by liberalism, which he saw as a Jewish plot to undermine European culture. Yeah. And was, I wouldn't call it liberalism, though. I mean, it's just Judaism. Okay, and was occupied by the United States and the Soviet Union, and that therefore Europe had to eschew nationalism and nation states and instead unite into a fascist super state, which would rejuvenate European culture and be capable of opposing the two superpowers of the Cold War. Shortly after writing Imperium, Yaki lived in London, UK, where he worked for a short time for a European contact section of fascist Oswald Mosley's union movement, allowing him to form ties with an underground fascist network throughout Europe, including Alfred Frank Gricsch, a former SS official and the leader of the neo-Nazi Brudenschaft organization. Following Yaki's falling out with Mosley, he formed, with the support of Baroness Alice von Flügel and help of former Mosleyites, the European Liberation Front, whose aim was to liberate Europe from the U.S. and the USSR. Yaki's perception of the U.S. was itself negative in that he considered it to be little more than a bastardized colony of Europe, which had developed from the influence of non-European minorities and had come under Jewish control, and he therefore considered the impact of American capitalism as more destructive than Soviet repression for European culture, and thus considered Soviet control as preferable to American domination of Europe. It sounds like some more Dugin shit, okay? It's not Americans that are dominating Europe. I mean, it's Jews that are sending our military all over the world. So Jews control your country. They control my country. They control almost every single country out there. And it's not America, you know, or the West. Dugin likes to blame the West and America. It's our fault that MTV is degenerate. It's not the Jews that run this stuff. No, no, no. Okay. Hence, he urged fascists not to collaborate with American anti-communism during the Cold War. And unlike most fascists who collaborated with U.S. intelligence during the Cold War, Yaki's European Liberation Front instead remained neutral and had a pan-European approach of geopolitics, with Yaki praising Soviet policy in Germany and seeking to secretly organize neo-Nazis in West Germany, who would then collaborate with the Soviet military against American occupation. His aim was, of course, to form the European fascist superstate whose designs he laid out in Imperium. It reminds me, too, of whenever you criticize these Nazbols in other countries and their controlled opposition movements, they love to just go, oh, you stupid fucking American inbred piece of shit, dumb American Amerimutt. Like, they love to let their America hatred out there. Look, I don't love America and everything that it stands for, right? I mean, it's not like it's some great place. There aren't really any great places left because they're not in our control. But the regular people here that have nothing to do with what's going on, I don't think they should be blamed for anything. They're victims just like other people are in other countries. All right, let's read. This is so freaking long. I don't know. I don't know. It's just really interesting, though, because it gets into all these different characters. Maybe I'll just read a little bit of it, and then we'll move on. I'll save it for another show, because you guys might get bored. My voice is getting kind of tired, too. All right, so hence he urged fascists not to collaborate. Yes, we've been through that. Okay. Having lost his political ties in the United Kingdom, Yockey instead entered West Germany clandestinely with army documents, stating Yockey was promoting a national Bolshevist movement and contacting ex-Wehrmacht and ex-Nazi officers, among whom the Social Reich Party, a Strasserist party, whose founder, the ex-Wehrmacht member Otto Ernst Remmer, praised Imperium. Remmer attacked Konrad Adenauer as an American puppet, denied the Holocaust, and dismissed the Nazi regime's atrocity as Allied propaganda, and agitated against the Allied occupation of West Germany while never criticizing East Germany and the Soviet Union, instead saying that he would show the Russians all the ways to the Rhine should a conflict erupt between the U.S. and the USSR, with Remmer's SRP receiving funding from the Soviets in the early 50s, something the Communist Party of Germany, with which the SRP temporarily worked against, Adenauer did not receive. Yockey then traveled around Europe distributing copies of his book to prominent neo-fascists, including French fascist Maurice Bardèche, himself one of the very first post-war Holocaust deniers, like Yockey and Julius Evola. Oh, God, Evola. Oh, I hope we get into our boy Evola. He's so freaking cool. Degenerate artist. Not even an artist. Loser. This stuff is terrible. All right. We'll finish this section, and then we'll save the other parts for another show. In Europe, Yockey participated in a conference by the Movimento Sociale Italiano, Europe's first neo-fascist party founded by veterans of Mussolini, Italian Social Republic, which was also attempting to form fascist networks. The conference amounted to little due to the aims of the various fascist groups involved present being at odds with each other, and with internal strife within the MSI itself over whether to adopt an Atlanticist strategy and align with NATO and the West, or a pan-European third position strategy opposed to both the Americans and the Soviets, with the anti-communist MSI eventually allying with NATO and the U.S., who were more concerned with opposing the Italian Communist Party instead of punishing fascists in these early days of the Cold War. Yockey's advocacy for allying with the Soviet Union did not find very receptive audiences among these fascists, with many pan-European fascists, including Julius Evola, oh, there he is, who had erstwhile praised Yockey's book, being skeptical of his ideas. Returning to the USA, Yockey worked with infamous anti-communist U.S. Senator Joseph McCarthy and with H. Keith Thompson, an American fascist who was the American representative of the Socialist Reich Party, and worked for the defense of Otto Ernst Remmer. Thompson defended Hitler and the Nazi regime and would remain in connection with Yockey until his death. In 1950, he would give a speech at a conference by far-right preacher Gerald L.K. Smith's Christian Nationalist Party, where he would call the Nuremberg trials a sham and claim the supposed existence of a global Jewish conspiracy. The supposed existence. Yeah, oh no, it's totally fake. In the early 1940s, Stalin initially adopted a pro-Zionist foreign policy, despite Lenin himself having condemned Zionism as a reactionary bourgeois movement, with the hope that Israel would be a socialist bulwark against British hegemony, and supported the UN plan for the partition of Palestine, and by extension endorsed the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, and the subsequent creation of the colonial Israeli state. The Soviet Union was the second state to recognize Israel after the United States, though the Soviet bloc soon did a foreign policy volte-face and threw its support behind Arab nationalist movements after Israel emerged as a Western ally. However, far from being merely anti-Zionist and in opposition to Israel only, Soviet policy in Stalin's later days became outright anti-Semitic. Oh, yeah, totally. And you know what he did? He sent them all here to the United States. So yeah, what a guy. How great. You know, David Duke would be happy. He's proud. He's proud of his boy. Okay, yeah, so the Eastern Bloc faced a wave of anti-Semitic purges in the 1950s, which included the Night of the Murdered Poets and the Doctor's Plot. It is in this context that Yaki, visiting Europe again, found himself attending the 1952 show trials in Prague, during which 11 Jewish members of the Czechoslovak Communist Party, including its secretary general, Rudolf Slansky, were executed on charges of being Zionists, Trotskyites, Western imperialists, and Tsiaoists. Titaoists? Slansky was, on the contrary, staunchly anti-Zionist. Yaki considered this to be the end of American hegemony in Europe and thought it foretold a Russian break with Jewry, which he saw as a favorable development in the fight to liberate Europe. Yeah, right. For Yaki, the wave of anti-Semitic purges was a declaration of war by Russia on the American Jewish leadership. And he therefore cooperated with Soviet bloc intelligence and became a paid courier of the Czech secret services, who themselves worked for the KGB. And he started advocating for a tactical alliance between fascists and the USSR to end the American occupation of Europe. Not the Jewish occupation. No. Back to New York, Yaki's report on the Soviet bloc anti-Semitic purges led James Madol of the National Renaissance Party, an American Nazi party, to endorse the campaigns against rootless cosmopolitans and Zionists, which here is a coded anti-Semitic term referring to Jews rather than to actual colonialist ideology of Zionism. Yeah, okay. Madol declared communism as a mask for Russian nationalism following the triumph of Stalin over Trotsky, whom they saw as the leader of the Jewish internationalist faction, thus in his eyes transforming what fascists considered to be Jewish Bolshevism into national Bolshevism. The National Resistance Party itself started praising the Soviet Union and had portraits of Hitler and Stalin on its walls, attracting both communists and Nazis, and certain American fascists started praising the Soviet Union as a result, and this is what we're seeing today. This is exactly what we're seeing today. Dissatisfied with the anti-communism of the majority of the U.S. far right, who is not very receptive to his national Bolshevik ideology, and was at odds with his sympathy for the Stalinist USSR and for the Third Worldist movements, Yaki traveled around the world, clandestinely going to East Germany and possibly to the USSR, writing propaganda for the Egyptian information industry and meeting Egyptian President Abdel Gamal Nasser, under whom thousands of Nazi war criminals, including Yaki's collaborator Otto Ernst Rammer, fleeing Europe, found refuge in Egypt. Yaki spent some weeks in Cuba shortly after the Cuban Revolution, where dictator Fulgencio Batista was overthrown, seeking to form new ties again though his attempts failed, before being arrested by the FBI in 1960 and imprisoned. In jail, Yaki is recorded to have lamented the capture of Nazi war criminal Adolf Eichmann and praised Hitler as a hero. Yaki eventually committed suicide in jail by swallowing cyanide. How the hell did he get cyanide in jail? Allegedly to protect his contacts. I don't know about that. Before his suicide, Yaki was visited in jail by Willis Carto, who would then become one of the main advocates of Yaki's ideology in North America. Although Carto rejected Yaki's own rejection of biological racism and his anti-American and pro-Soviet position, Carto's organization, the Liberty Lobby, distributed Yaki's writings through its newspaper Spotlight and its publisher, Noontide Press, republished Imperium. Therefore, Yaki's core ideology could be seen consisting of a cultural rather than biological racism, rejection of nationalism in favor of European superstate, and support for pro-Soviet and Third Worldist forces against American hegemony and liberal democracy, which he considered to be a Jewish plot. It sounds just like Dugin. Yaki's ideology has been very influential among post-war neo-fascists, and his book is distributed among Nazis and white supremacists, with former leader of the neo-Nazi British National Party, John Tyndall, praising Imperium, and is influential among far-right neo-pagans and occultists. So it's just interesting, and this whole Imperium thing, they made a movie about, you know, white nationalist neo-Nazis with the Harry Potter guy, and it was called Imperium. So it's just interesting. Yeah, this is a super long article. Maybe I will, you know, just read it bit by bit over the next few weeks because it is very long. But it's interesting because we need to understand where all these groups came from, what they are, what they stand for, who the players are. There's a lot. So let me leave. Okay, I left off right when we get into the European New Right. So we will cover that next time. So now I thought we can get into this Alain Soral guy. I'll play a little bit of the video that this guy. Let me look into this guy. So he
Jose.
Oh my God. He has a YouTube channel called The Almighty. He has the life rune. Let's see. The terrorist attack on the Cathedral of Notre Dame. Oh, geez. Is he saying this is real? Let's see. Yeah, he's claiming that non-whites, I guess, started the fire at Notre Dame. I'm sorry. I don't buy that at all. I don't. And, I don't know. This dude's just suspicious to me. I'm just saying. Let's see. Gab the Almighty. Let's see what he gabs about. Sharing Tom Metzger stuff. Interesting. Huh, let's see. I see #Brenton Tarrant on this guy's gab page. The New Awakening. It looks like the Northwest Front or something. I'm just going to let Kyle know that this dude is super shady. If you're... Brenton Tarrant shoots Muslim invaders. All right, I'm going to go tell Kyle. So remember that guy that did the Alain Soral video?
Yeah.
So I was just looking at his gab, and he's like, #Brenton Tarrant, and like, oh, so freaking shilly.
Yeah.
And, oh, the terrorists attacked the cathedral. Yeah. Did he approach you?
I don't know if that's the guy who actually had posted the video.
Okay.
On the Tribune. It could have been somebody else who was just trying to share that guy's
opinion. Yeah. I mean, the information in the video is legit. I'm going to go over it, but like, that dude is so freaking...
Not
shady. Yeah, yeah.
He seemed like it.
Yeah, and how is he still up on YouTube? And why is he speaking English? It's like it was made just for, like, you know, our audience.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there was a lot of hatred that came from Alain Soral being exposed, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
In the comment section, a lot of which I did not let through.
Yeah.
You stupid Americans!
Yeah. But yeah, that guy is shady as hell, though, the one that's doing the video.
Are you going to talk about Nord Front with their...
I have, Russian, yeah. Stuff? Yes, I talked about that, and I was getting into just the history of national Bolshevism and, like, how far back it goes, and there's a huge article that I'm going to finish up reading throughout the weeks, but...
Well, it seems like a lot of people want to perhaps view Stalin as one of the...
Anti-Semite.
One of the originators of that kind of...
Yeah.
Thinking. I'm not too certain on it, but I just know that people like Bob in D.C.,
uh-huh.
Wolf Wall Street,
David Duke.
Yeah, they like to try to rehabilitate Stalin as a great nationalist.
Mm-hmm.
National Bolshevik.
Yeah. Yeah. They're trying to tie nationalism and communism together. It's just retarded. All right, but let's listen to the information in this video, although this dude is super suspicious.
In this video, I will explain you why the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris...
Okay, you guys, he starts the video as, "Hello, my fellow white men." So, then we've got Tabitha's ex-boyfriend here. Okay.
All hail, my fellow white men. In this video, I will talk to you about the French far right. I will make two videos about it. The first video will be about Alain Soral and his organization, and the second video will be about the French far right in general, the historical far right. I know now for years that Alain Soral and his organization is known in the USA, in the rest of Europe, but people are just projecting on him the ideas they want about France. Racists all over the world, nationalists, want to think that in France you have people struggling, resisting, fighting against what is happening right now in Europe and particularly in France. And so they would want, they imagine that you have some very courageous guy who are fighting. Unfortunately, it's not the case. Yes, Alain Soral and his organization are anti-Semite, but they are not anti-Semite for the good reasons. This is very important. I will explain you that. Alain Soral is described as someone racist from the far right because, as a Nazi, a fascist, because he's anti-Semite. But Alain Soral is anti-Semite because he is really anti-racist. Alain Soral is anti-Semite because he knows that the Jews are pretending to be anti-racist, but in reality, the Jews are racist against Goyim, and they just want the Goyim to be anti-racist, so they will mix their blood, they will disappear, you know the music. And so Soral is shocked by the fact that the Jews don't want really to mix all the races and them, so the Jews would mix with everyone, the whites would mix with brown.
Okay, yeah, 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 we get it. Let's get to the actual information about Alain Soral. He says that, you know, I guess this guy is very similar to Dugin. Okay, so now he's getting into the information. He started out as a communist, this Alain Soral. He again references his fellow white men here, so it's just really weird, but okay.
He started as a communist and as an homosexual in the very center of Paris. Alain Soral never worked of his life. When he was young, he was a prostitute to old Jewish men. That's why
nice.
He hates them so much, because Jewish men were fucking Soral in the ass. And Soral, by being a prostitute to Jewish men, he was thinking he would be able to enter those cycles of the cinema, the show business, and that he will be able to make a career.
Okay, you know, if you want to watch the rest of the video, go ahead. I don't know. It's just too long. But yeah, Alain Soral, you can check it out on the Renegade Tribune. Okay, so I asked, you know, isn't Alain Soral a Mason as well? And the person who posted this video, or I don't know if it's the guy in the video, says, he said in an interview that he was introduced to it when he was working in the show business, if I recall. In ENR, there was several ex-Mason like Stéphane Blett or Jacob Cohen. This is interesting. Alain Soral, of the real name Alain Bonnet, or Bonnet, ex-member of the Parti Communiste François, is of Swiss origin and an actor originally, so it's very probable that he is a Freemason. Égalité et Réconciliation has promoted a lot of Putin, Dugin, Christ Insane, racial mixing, and good street Jews propaganda. Maybe he meant good sweet Jews. He has shilled a lot for Trump and that Front National too. So even if he doesn't attack white people directly, he certainly doesn't do a lot of good for them. The only good thing he could be found of doing is putting good arguments against the Holocaust and many aspects of the international Judaism. But still, with that many red flags, he should be a call out as a subversive Knots bull. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Another comment. Considering Soral's homosexual inclinations, young Italian-born nationalist Daniel Conversano, it's like Converso, clashed him in a video where Danny also criticized Soral's praise of the North Korean regime. It's more Knots bull stuff. Since the video is only in French, I will translate here the passages about gay Soral. I would like to remind Alain Soral he listened to me so-so that it ain't me who... What? Oh, sucked, you know what, to climb the social ladder during the 80s. It ain't me who tested anal sex with my pals for sociological reasons, as he would have us to believe. In his book, Misery de Désir, Poverty of Desire. Figuring out that by revealing this disgusting anecdote, he would free himself from the burden of this abomination to make us forget that, contrary to me, he has effed in the... But so a faggot. Excerpt, we should not be lying. Teenagehood is a time for experiments and for the future intellectual who wonders about the mysteries of the world. Homosexuality is a topic, among others, that must arise to his consciousness, either in order to get an accurate idea or to rest assured that you haven't tried yet. And how would you know you ain't one of them? The heathed-minded youth gets a taste of it someday, either in contact with other men, either in a funnier way, threesomes, ew, an adventure that ends up repressed in adulthood in distant, shameful past. Ah, Black and I, armed with our poor experiences of life, have fallen on an agreement. During the anal sexual act we had both in order to get an erection, close our eyes, and think intensely about a woman. Yeah, I'm sure you did. This is so gay. I can't believe this guy wrote this. Instinctively, without talking to each other, we resorted to the same trick to put an end to all of this. And concerning passive anal, neither he nor I really enjoyed it to want to start again. Conclusion, you're a big faggot, Sorrel. Sounds funny, hey? Many of you, especially those in their 20s or the Arabian youths who haven't read his books, they will fall from grace with this video. If you don't believe me, if you think it's just fiction, please listen to Alain Sorrel himself dealing with it. Here's some audio, apparently. Alain, answer my questions, please. Yes, is it different between guys or between women? Between guys, we understand each other. I tried to see what it's like when you want to try it. Around midnight, you can do it, and it's done. In a garden in Paris, in about 1.5 hours. What? Oh my God. Tons and tons of years training in a sports club cannot erase the fact that you've been used as a woman by a man. Oh, that's just sociology for sure. We believe you. You know it can happen to the greatest ones. Julius Caesar also sucked dicks before dominating Rome. But you have to realize you cannot unsuck a dick. When you do, well, it's done forever. You received male penises in your bottom for real, to speak like kindergartners. You can say otherwise. But it won't render a real tragic event I didn't live. Oh my God. Okay, it goes on. That's just funny. I guess this guy's just a total faggot. There's a fight between Daniel Conversano and Alain Sorrel. Oh gosh. So I've just been looking at Augustus Olenvictus's Instagram and Twitter and all that. I'm trying to figure out when he's going to do his next speech so I can drive down and hold up my Crowley quotes and see if anybody has a problem with that. Thank you. I just got a matcha delivery. You're the best. All right. So what I found, let's see. So first of all, we have one of these really super edgy, you know, Adam Waffen style propaganda posters. And I'm pretty sure that they're doing like the, it looks like they're doing that little like Fortnite dance that those kids do. I don't even know if it's Fortnite, but like they do this little thing with their hands. Looks like that's happening, but it's someone holding a gun and then like saluting or something. And it says, revolution! We're Invictus Youth at protonmail.com. Invictus Youth. You know what? I think I'm gonna email him and be like, so what's up? Like, what can I do as an Invictus Youth? Like, can you, you know, like sacrifice me in a ritual or like drink my blood? What's on the agenda here for Invictus Youth? That's terrifying. We've got this Thelemite psycho at getting youth involved with his weird shit. All right. Then there's another picture of him and it might be one of the guys from Power Through Discipline because they're saying, what did they say? Pressure con, pressure to power. Oh, Master Chim. Okay, I guess he's a black belt in jiu-jitsu, but that dude just looks like I'm sure he's strong, but he looks like a little bowling ball or something. Like, he has no neck. He just doesn't look very healthy. Oh my God, he does green belts at his academy. No, I hate him. Green belts are so freaking dumb. It's basically just it's like a retention tool to keep people paying for jiu-jitsu. Because green belts, no, it's just retarded. It's white belt, blue belt. No one gets a green belt. Ugh, whatever. So yeah, it's him and Master Chim, who's like, oh, I don't know, 4'9". And hashtag MMA. I'm pretty sure Augustus Olenvictus does not fight MMA. I could be wrong. Okay, and then there's this picture where he looks demonically possessed. And he looks like he's in some kind of mansion. It says, hashtag Aleister Crowley, hashtag Thoth, hashtag Thelema, hashtag wedding feast, hashtag magician, southern living. Oh my God. Yeah, it looks like he's wearing eyeliner too. He's probably just a fag. And then this one's just your average family initiation ceremony, you know, like classic family activity that we all did with our parents. Yeah, so he's showing, they've got like Thelemic stars or whatever painted on their foreheads. They're all wearing black. And it says, family initiations last night for Salome and Jezebel. He named his freaking daughter Jezebel. Oh, God. Yeah, get spooky. Hashtag summer solstice. Gotta love this comment. I know nothing about that. However, big congratulations. Like, these people are stupid. This dude is a Thelemite. He is a Crowleyite. These people are what you guys all call Satanists, okay? This, you should maybe learn something about it instead of being like, I don't know what the hell that's about, but like, I still support you because you're popular and stuff. You know what? Like, this is the thing. I get mad at our people, good people doing nothing, more than I do at these pieces of shit just doing what they do, because that's what they do. We can't really change that, but we can change how we react to that. So it's very frustrating to not see our people hold leadership accountable. And Kyle and I can't be the ones to do it because they all hate us. And, you know, we're the ones that have been saying it for years. So it has to be new other people stepping up and saying like, no, you don't speak for us. Showing up to these events and saying, hey, look, this guy is not some white nationalist dude. This dude is a freaking Crowleyite piece of shit. This guy is not on our side. And, you know, it's time that people stopped letting these leaders speak for you and spoke up for yourselves and said, hey, look, this dude doesn't speak for me. I don't know who the hell he is. He doesn't speak for white people. He certainly isn't even white himself. I don't know what he is. But, okay, so there's that picture, you know, just family initiation. But yeah, I could use some help finding out where this guy is going to do his next speech. I mean, I know he's in Florida. Oh, wow. Here's him and his wife, like, dressed up in some ridiculous thing. And she has, like, her hand hidden in his jacket. The chemical wedding. Alchemy, magic, pagan wedding. Enochian Thelema. I love this. Did she make that crown? Oh my god, future empress. Ugh, god. Okay, I don't understand how one of his daughters is like Mexican because his wife doesn't look Mexican. So I don't know if that's just like a random one. It's just weird. I don't know. I don't get it. And then he's got like a brown son. So I don't know. Maybe they're just one of those like polyamorous families or something. I don't know. That could be it. Oh, the Rise Above movement. These awesome MMA guys. None of them actually are MMA fighters, but you know, doesn't stop them from making really cool videos. Oh, here he is with Stephen McNallen drinking mead out of a horn. So, you know, he's way better than everybody else because he's drinking out of a horn. Come on. That gets like 10 trad points automatically. Oh, cool. He has a little Pepe with a helicopter for his children to play with. That's cool. That's freaking, what a shitlord, right? That's hilarious. Promoting Siege. Oh, here's a nice little picture of Aleister Crowley. Oh, cool. Wow, he's got a family picture and one of his little daughters is like posing all sexy. It's really creepy. She's got like a kissy face and she's like pushing her chest forward. Like, oh god. Hashtag gangster. Yeah, that's usually what I post when I post pictures of my family. I'm like, hashtag gangster. Look at my little girl pimping herself out already. It's freaking awesome. Gangsta. Yeah, this guy's awesome. This guy's great. The amount of pictures he has of his children sleeping is just weird. It's just really weird. Like, why? Why does anybody post pictures of their children in the first place? I mean, I get it if you're a proud parent. I know. Like, I'm one too. But there are freaks out there. And, you know, just posting your kids' pictures all over the place, especially when you're in, like, some kind of thought leader, is just reckless. But then again, I mean, I guess if you raise your children in Thelema, you probably don't give a shit about your children in the first place. So why would you even care if any of this negatively affects them? So is he training with Master Chim? Like, I don't even get it. Every now and then you wander into a room full of people who remind you of how much you have to do. I'm always honored to be the runt of the litter at Jungle Gym. Where is Master Chim's gym? So it looks like his gym is in the Bronx. Hmm. Back in the day, he used to be a lot less fat. Watching his MMA fight here. I mean, he's like a short dude, but he used to look a lot healthier. Yeah. It's like he choked his opponent out. That's pretty cool. Okay, so for my next segment of the show, I wanted to get into this weird freaking guy on YouTube, okay? His name is Chris Ulner, And now I came across this when I was taking the year off from doing Renegade, and I was in the field working as a therapist for children with developmental disabilities, autism, behavioral disturbances. You know, usually we would get the kids that nobody knew what the hell to do with. They were like, they were getting kicked out of kindergarten. Basically, my job was to ensure that these children made it through kindergarten, okay? Which is just sad. And it's not the children's faults. It's this, the entire school system is retarded. So anyways, during that time, I obviously had a lot of resources that I was looking into for therapy ideas, you know, training my new therapist how to do everything and trying to get videos together. So I came across this Chris Ulmer guy, and he runs a channel called Special Books for Special Kids. Now, this dude is so creepy looking, and it appears that he's Jewish as well. If you just go look up his, you know, channel, you'll see he's talking to children that are severely damaged. I mean, to the point where some of them are just vegetables, like, sitting there. It's really sad. But he's, like, creepily really happy about being there, and he gets, like, super close to these kids, and he looks creepy. I actually found a thread on Poll, which I thought was funny because I didn't know if anybody had even heard of this guy, because, like, not everybody looks into special needs stuff, right? So there are several threads, I guess, on Poll. It just says, Jew Chad presents a great reason for eugenics. I cannot fucking stand this guy. He talks to brainless kids who literally have no functioning brains and can only drool. It's insulting. Is this guy some sort of pedo? Can someone please red pill me on this guy? What the fuck is this Tardcock Gobbler's endgame? Now, it's extremely sad what's happened to these children, and it's by no accident. This is being engineered. You know, these children were probably poisoned, or their mothers were poisoned, and, you know, it's not normal for these people to be this way. And I personally don't think it's any way to live. I would not want to live, like, in a vegetative state. I don't know. Maybe I wouldn't even be aware of it, but yeah. If that ever happens to me, pull the plug, please. Someone says here, this crazed pedophile and amateur freak show presenter is forcing himself to smile around deformed half-wit monstrosities on YouTube as an easy way to get into the pants of disabled children and their distressed mothers while grabbing plenty of cash and a cheap moral high along the way. This is Pizzagate in plain sight. We need to put all the facts together and present a case to the authorities. I wouldn't be surprised if he is using the same equipment that he records his interviews with to record child molestation just minutes thereafter. It's certainly possible. This guy just creeps me out. Okay, I gotta just play some of this for you. I mean, you can go watch it if you want to see how crazy creepy this is. Like, he's got his arm around this kid that he just met. Yeah, okay. And then we'll get into his intro song, which is even creepier. So here he is with his arm around this kid, this poor child who has a very deformed face. It's like a cleft palate, but it's gone all the way up. Like, poor child. I mean, it's very sad. Okay.
At home. They weren't going to sustain his life at the hospital until my husband told him to, because they didn't feel that Trey's life was viable.
I mean, look, I understand a mother's love. Like, I probably wouldn't want my deformed child to be euthanized either. But, like, does this child have a quality of life? He seems to be severely mentally handicapped and, you know, is, like, chewing on stuff and drooling and... I'm not going to say that should be done in every case, but, like, does this child have a quality of life? And back in the day, before we had, like, such hospital care, I mean, nature's kind of cruel sometimes. People would just, like, leave deformed babies, and that's sad. I mean, I probably couldn't do that, but, you know, it's like, is this a quality of life? I don't think so, but okay. Let's get to the intro. Where's the intro? Okay, here it is.
Welcome to SBSK. Join me as I travel around the world and interview individuals living with a condition to prove no matter how you communicate or what obstacles you face, you're always deserving of love and acceptance. So without hesitation, let's meet today's friend.
Okay. So also, this guy did some interview that I think was completely fake, and I see these stories coming out all the time about some attractive, normal woman who's in love with this, like, wheelchair-bound freak-looking thing. And it's just such bullshit. An interlabeled love story, intimacy and disability. Okay, listen to the beginning of this. This is such bullshit. There's no way that this woman is actually in love with this wheelchair dude who looks so deformed. Okay, here we go.
Our relationship is normal and exciting, and she helps me poop, but otherwise, we're just a regular couple that has fun and gets into arguments and...
Yeah, this is just so normal. Totally normal. Yeah, I really believe that this woman is with this man. I mean, come on. Okay, listen to this actress here.
Love for Shane is definitely both physical and emotional.
She's physically attracted to this thing in a wheelchair, really. And it's not just a regular-looking guy in a wheelchair. Like, he is very weird-looking.
I love his personality. He's a wonderful boyfriend. And we definitely connect physically. I love his body and...
We connect physically. She has sex with this thing. I'm sorry. I'm not trying to dehumanize it, but, like, come on. Really?
Everything about him, really.
I love his body. Yeah, his deformed body. Okay. Oh, my God. The couple has their own YouTube channel. Oh, jeez. I've got to check it out. This is so fake. They call themselves Squirmy and Grubs. Oh, my God. This is just a freak show. This is ridiculous. Oh, my God. They mounted a camera on Shane's wheelchair, and they called it Shane Cam. Oh, God. Here she is carrying him to the pool like he's a little baby because he's, like, miniature size. So his wife is just, like, carrying him out to the pool. This is just ridiculous. Okay, but then it got me looking into this this Jewish organization, Chaim. Where is it? Because they had done, or High Life, Chai Life. They had done an article on that Chris Ulner guy. And endorsing him, and it seems like he's a fellow Chosenite. I mean, just looking at him, he looks like fellow Chosenite. But let's see here. Yeah, this High Lifeline, and I noticed all of these charities that are helping special needs kids are run by Jews, and it just disgusts me because they cause this problem to begin with, even in their own people. I mean, their own people are inbred. That's a lot of the reason why they have these degenerative diseases, but... Then there are others that are just poisoned, their own and obviously non-Jews. And then they just exploit them and try to make money off of them. You know, they do fundraisers and charity stuff. And really, they're just pocketing the money. And children are still being poisoned and made to be this way. So it's really sad and it's disgusting. Just briefly back to Augustus Sol Invictus, because I was looking a little bit more at his Invictus for President site, and it's just interesting the little slogans that he has. Dismantle the deep state, eat the bankers. That just reminds me of the whole commie eat the rich stuff. Okay, so switching topics again. Tammy had posted a video of this cult that I guess was in Australia called The Family. It was run by a woman named Anne Hamilton Byrne, who, you know, has blonde hair and blue eyes. But to me, it looks like a Jewess with a nose job. I mean, I could be wrong. So let me just read a little article about this cult. Now, the official story is that Anne Byrne, she was basically a Nazi because she dyed all of the children's hair blonde. But even in the pictures in this documentary video that I was watching about it, not all of the children are blonde, and the ones that are, it looks natural. It looks like this woman chose blonde-haired, blue-eyed children on purpose. Not that she dyed their hair that color, but that she was getting these children for a certain purpose. These children were relentlessly abused. Many of them ended up killing themselves. And the woman never, you know, admitted that she did anything wrong. It was just sick. I believe some people are even saying that Julian Assange was part of this cult or something. So, okay, let's read this. During the making of a new documentary and book about The Family, the notorious Australian cult led by the dangerous, charismatic Anne Hamilton Byrne, former cult child Dr. Sarah Moore died suddenly. She was only 46 and at home in Melbourne after struggling with physical and mental health problems for decades. Sarah was a good person. She was compassionate and highly intelligent and loved by her friends and family, her real family, not the cult that said it was a family but never was. The cult had long tentacles into political, academic, medical, and judicial worlds, but its home bases were remote, in a secluded street among mountain ash gums in Melbourne's outer suburban Dandenong ranges, and on Lake Eildon in Victoria's northeast. Besides the lake, it had a house where it imprisoned 14 children from 1972 to 87, where they were freed in a raid by police. Sarah was among the oldest, and she became the fulcrum for the children at the house they dubbed Up Top. These were the kids dressed identically, and most with dyed blonde hair. Now, again, in this picture right here, not all of them have blonde hair, so if she was dyeing their hair blonde, why did she not dye one, two, three, four of the kids' hair? It looks like she just had these kids that were blonde. That's what it looks like, and I think that's what they don't want getting out there. They want to paint it that she was a Nazi, so she dyed all of their hair, you know, blonde to make a master race, but really she was probably a Jewess, picking out these children specifically because they had these features. Okay. Because we see a redhead here, too. Just before the police raid, Sarah had been thrown out and with fellow cult child Leanne helped direct the authorities to the house and what lay within. Beatings, a regime of drugs, brainwashing, and starvation. Yeah, they apparently had a bucket that they would, like, water torture the kids in. They'd, like, dunk their heads in and... It just sounded like they went through some extreme psychological trauma. They were told to hide in the walls when people would come over. They'd be there for hours, just stacked into a little crawl space. Very similar to how the brothels in Israel operate, or the sex slave dungeons, really, that's what they are. Okay, so with Melbourne filmmaker Rosie Jones, I have spent the past 2 years researching the inner workings of the cult, talking to survivors, lawyers, police, and many, many sources who wished to remain anonymous. We wanted to know why this was allowed to happen. We knew the during and after, but what happened before? Who were the enablers? Why Melbourne? Why did so many smart adults give money, children, and lives to this woman? The last question was what intrigued us most. Sorry, a cat just... I can't see my screen. Please sit down. Okay, there we go. Okay, we're both interested in stories about what people are prepared to believe. I've written a lot about Jehovah's Witnesses, the Bible sect, friends and workers, extremists, fundamentalists, and fringe dwellers. Rosie has made several films about religious communities and another about a UFO sighting in Melbourne. The family was irresistible. Rosie had been on the story much longer than I had. By the time we met, she had developed strong relationships with many of the people Hamilton Byrne tainted, including Sarah, Leanne, and other children, now adults, who she stole via shonky adoptions or got from compliant cult mothers. Rosie had directed a documentary, and together we wrote a book. Both are called The Family. It's interesting that you have The Family over here in the United States, too, with Manson's whole thing. Okay. Before she died, Sarah approved of the film, but she had not read the book she helped so much with. She had always spoken out on behalf of the victims, and despite poor health, had done so again for us, in more detail than ever before. Once I betrayed Anne, she said, I had fulfilled the role of Judas. Hamilton Byrne told her followers and her captives that she was Jesus. Every Messiah has to have a Judas. After leaving the cult, Sarah met her birth mother and enrolled at university, but struggled with her past. Taken at birth, locked away with changed names, and beaten and drugged with vast quantities of LSD in a standard cult initiation when she was 14. Yeah, apparently they would give these kids high doses of LSD and just lock them in a dark room. Yeah, that's great, huh? Wow. As a student doctor, she worked in Southeast Asia with refugees and the poor, but it was very hard for her. Sarah attempted suicide in 2008 and spent the rest of her short life in a wheelchair. That's so sad. She was a really good pianist as well. It showed in the little documentary she was playing piano. And it was really beautiful. Poor woman. Her funeral last year had a Buddhist theme. Fellow child survivors, now adults in various stages of recovery, spoke on her behalf. Her death was a reminder that even though the family formed in the 60s and was most active and harmful during the 70s and 80s, the consequences continue and will do for some time.
Hamilton Byrne, meanwhile, lives on. She is 96 and is in a Melbourne nursing home with dementia. When former Melbourne police detective Lex Damon, who initiated a task force to arrest Hamilton Byrne after many years of police inaction, heard about Sarah's death, he said to us, "Unjustly she dies while the cult leader continues to live." Yeah, that's true. Isn't that disgusting? And she continues to deny any of it. And now she has this other creepy Jewy looking guy who's taken over. And he looks just as crazy and demonic. All right. Demon, who grew close to the survivors as he led the Victorian police task force that pursued Hamilton Byrne after she fled overseas, says she essentially got away with it. Sarah was thrashed, cult survivors remember. She has them all dressed up like the Von Trapp family here with their, you know, a lot of blondes. A lot of, like, Kyle phenotype. Not just blonde, but, like, toe head, no eyebrow blonde. Like, blonde eyelashes, everything. There's a specific type that she was looking for. It's very obvious. Okay. And they're all white. Wow, isn't that weird? Okay, when he finally managed to extradite her back to Victoria in 94, he could only change her and her third husband, Bill Byrne, charge them with fraud offenses to do with faked birth certificates. They were fined $5,000 each. She and Byrne did not face more serious charges, potentially including assault, kidnapping, and the drugs, because of complex legal and ethical issues. One of the questions investigators and prosecutors asked each other was, should vulnerable survivors be re-traumatized by forcing them through cross-examination? For Demand, a former arson squad policeman who just stumbled on the case by accident, the issue of whether justice was served is a thorny one. His answer is yes, but also no. However, he says, we were able to show that she was no one special. One of the most profound moments for Rosie and me was meeting Hamilton Byrne. She couldn't consent to us doing so and couldn't be interviewed because of her dementia, but we were taken to see her. By this time, we had both been shocked by the things we had learned about her. The dictatorial way in which she meted out cruel punishments on the children, for example. She would often phone the Lake Eildon house from afar, Britain, Hawaii, or New York, where she also accumulated properties, to order one of her cult lieutenants called the Aunties to beat or punish a child without hanging up. She liked to hear the screams down the phone line. Ugh, man. But what was the truth? We were not in that house or other cult houses in the 70s and 80s, and Hamilton Byrne cannot be questioned by anyone any longer. Instead, we mined source after source of material, including tapes of Hamilton Byrne speaking to her devotees. These little kids are just so innocent and angelic and adorable looking. Like, it just, to think of them being abused, it makes me want to cry. It's so sad. They're just, they look like little angels. And look, I have a child that looks like a little angel and he can act like a little devil. I get it. Like, sometimes kids can be, woo, oh my. But to beat them, like, that's just not right. It's not right at all. Doesn't mean that we don't get angry with our children and raise our voice once in a while and maybe say things we shouldn't have, but to beat these kids and freaking drown them, and it's just disgusting. I don't know how you could live with yourself after doing such things. It's just disgusting to me. I mean, I wouldn't even really want to do that to, like, another person unless they really, like, hurt me or, like, deserved it, I guess. I don't know. It's just very sick. Okay, so moving on. One of her first followers, current cult member Michael Stevenson, Helmer, 68, agreed to help. He is the nephew of former Governor General Sir Zelman Cowen, or Cowen, C-O-W-E-N. It might be like a crypto Jew name, who knows. Cowen. and met Hamilton Byrne in 1967, this Sir Zelman Cowen. But he denied she had dementia, deflected all blame from her towards the Aunties, and painted survivors as victims of their own greed and ego. How disgusting. Is this the guy, current cult? I think maybe this is the guy that I saw on camera that was like the new cult leader, and he looked so psychotic. Little beady eyes. Yeah, there he is. That is a Jew. That is a Jew. I'm just going to go double check. Okay, so I just found this little write-up on Stevenson Helmer, Michael Stevenson Helmer, who was the son of Zelman Cowen. I guess he was an Australian legal scholar.
and some other BS. But anyways, yeah, this guy, the current cult leader of Hamilton Burns cult, is a Jew. It says, Michael was a 19-year-old law student when he first became interested in Eastern religion and joined the family. He comes from a prominent Jewish family of high achievers, including Sir Zelman Cowen. I'm sure that's Cohen. It's got to be. Governor General of Australia from 1977 to 82, Michael remains a devoted follower of Anne Hamilton Byrne and visits her almost daily in the suburban Melbourne nursing home where she now lives. This is a press kit from, I guess, a world premiere at the Melbourne International Film Festival called The Family. So maybe I can find that documentary. I'm sure it'd be interesting. Back to the original article. So yes, we have established that this dude is a Jew. I'm just gonna make a wild guess that Anne Hamilton Byrne is a Jewess as well. Okay, it looks like she's had a nose job, probably has dyed hair, and she hates Aryan children and beats them and gets a lot of satisfaction out of beating these little angel children. So probably a Yenta. Okay. So he denied that she had dementia, deflected all blame for her towards the aunties, and painted the survivors as, you know, crazy. She has been indestructible, he said. Oh, inscrutable. My bad. She walks on. And so we sat with Hamilton Byrne in her tiny room in the nursing home at his invitation. This once powerful, dangerous woman has been reduced to a skeletal shell, snapping in and out of sleep, talking in riddles, cuddling a plastic doll, and drinking through a straw surrounded by photographs of the children she said were her own. On her wall is a print of Leonardo da Vinci's The Last Supper, the defining image of a grand betrayal about to happen. And this is what Hamilton Byrne's story is about, power and betrayal. She betrayed all those she sucked in. She took something of their souls while promising to save them. But then she was spectacularly betrayed by herself, by several of those in her inner circle, her disciples, who had had enough. Once that had happened, she gradually lost her power and then her freedom, and her slide toward death, which she always said she could cheat, began. The cult's motto was unseen, unheard, unknown, and she used to make her followers recite a mantra promising loyalty. For neither have I betrayed any secrets to thine enemies, it read in part, nor have I given the kiss of Judas. Before she was the infamous Anne Hamilton Byrne, she was plain Evelyn Edwards from country Victoria. She was born in Sale, I don't know how you say that, 2 hours east of Melbourne in 1921, and grew up in strange, unsettled circumstances. Her hometown back then was a small farming town with one main street. As an adult, she would change her name regularly. She would also change her appearance through cosmetic surgery. I knew it. I know a freaking plastic surgery face when I see it. It looked like a Michael Jackson nose. It really did. Yes, so she changed her appearance through cosmetic surgery, would drive Jaguars and Daimlers and wear Chanel wigs and expensive clothes. She had it's probably just a wig. She's probably just wearing a blonde wig. She had large collections of cats and dogs. Many people remember one particular red dress she wore to a 1970s cult party. She courted women with her mind and men with her body, some say. Her estate is estimated now at between $5 million and $10 million. It is controlled by cult interests, and sources predict an unholy scramble for cash and assets when she dies. Back in the 1920s and 30s, however, Anne was just Evelyn from Sale, the oldest of seven. Her mother, Florence Hoyle, was a South Londoner transplanted to Gippsland. Her father, Ralph Edwards, came from inner city Melbourne and had been discharged from the army during World War II because of poor health. Florence spent 27 years in mental hospitals and died in one. She was known in Sale as the lady who set fire to her hair in the street. Oh, cool. She claimed to be a medium who could speak to the dead. Ralph vanished for long periods. For a time, he was on the run from an unpaid war veteran's debt. When Evelyn was three, he had already abandoned the family and was living in a fishing port on Victoria's western coast. He gave his religion as spiritualist and his number of children as none. By the late 1950s, Evelyn had become Anne and had lost her first husband, Lionel Harris, in a car crash in Bathurst.
Harris, a car salesman, was driving home to Sydney because he and Anne had been cleared to adopt a baby boy from Barnardo's homes. The planned adoption proved to be a chilling portent of what was to come. She became a yoga teacher in Melbourne. The classes were popular, attracting middle-aged women, often Jewish, from wealthier suburbs. And why would Jews want to take yoga from a shiksa, right? Because they wouldn't. This lady's a freaking Jew. Anne began to tell her followers she was all they needed. And some of the women began to be drawn into her web. She started to preach a hybrid New Age philosophy, Christianity, Hinduism, and Buddhism. It's like Tabitha. All imbued with a cosmic promise of karmic cleansing and immortality, at a time when Melbourne's post-war suburban malaise was giving way to more esoteric thinking. Where you are now, she would say, is a season of your enfoldment. Her teachings promised a sort of reboot, an offer to start afresh in another realm after earthly death. Later, she preached apocalyptic doomsday scenarios and said the children she collected were her saved ones who would guide the planet to peace. We all have mental scarring. It's a quote from the cult survivors. Of course they do. There's no way you can, you know, leave a situation like that with no scarring. You are changed for life. As we can see, most of them have killed themselves or tried to kill themselves and then died. You know, just it. There's science behind this. I mean, children that aren't loved and cared for, they cannot develop properly. They're at a major disadvantage. Same thing happens with animals in nature. If a mom or a mother figure isn't there to teach them to do things and to hold them in a certain way that activates certain parts of their brain, then they don't fully develop. Okay. In 1962, Hamilton Byrne made her most important and until now largely unknown connection that would enable her to consolidate the cult that would shock Australia and elude authorities for the next three decades. You know, I have a hard time believing that the authorities had no idea about this cult. I mean, please. They were probably part of it, at least major players within the authorities. There's no way this cult was operating, this huge cult, without them knowing about this. I think they were complicit. Maybe not all, but I find that hard to believe. This is a big cult with all the movers and shakers in that area, and the police have no idea. Yeah. Okay. So, yes. Through acquaintances at the University of Melbourne, she heard of an eccentric, brilliant academic, Dr. Rayner Johnson, the head of Queen's College. He was 61, English, and on the tail end of a stellar career in physics. Oh, and we all know how reputable physicists are. They're just, oh, such practical stuff. Approaching retirement, he had turned his mind to Eastern religions and mysticism, from physics to metaphysics. He was also very well connected in Melbourne society and politics. Now he was looking for a master or teacher to guide him through a journey into deep spiritualism. Johnson lived on the grounds of the university. Hamilton Byrne rang his doorbell on a Saturday. "A day of destiny for me," he wrote. These people are very dramatic. 6 months later, Rayner was initiated into Hamilton Byrne's cult, which was then called the Great White Brotherhood of Initiates and Masters. She told him, the Great White Brotherhood. This is so ridiculous. It's obviously Jewish. All right, she told him he needed to take hallucinogenic drugs, either LSD or mushrooms, which he called sacred mana. Rayner wrote that Jesus spoke through Hamilton Byrne at the initiation at her home in the Dandenongs. You know, it's interesting, too. Okay, so you have this cult called The Family, and then you have The Family here with Manson and the whole Helter Skelter thing, and they're both racially based, right? So, they're, you know, the NLP here is that these cults were led by, like, white supremacist people, right? Totally not Jews abusing white children. Okay. So she named him John the Baptist. She would use him, his standing, and his connections to give her cult respectability. Many early members were recruited via his Council of Adult Education lectures around Melbourne. She told him she was Jesus returned to earth in disguise. "I and my father are one," he believed her, and he considered her supernaturally beautiful. He wrote, "I had met my master." He moved to the Dandenongs near Hamilton Byrne in a house she found and he bought from the former Deputy Prime Minister and Chief Justice, Sir John Latham. At the Colts Peak, one street in the Dandenongs suburb of Fernie Creek was predominantly owned by cult members because she wanted strength in numbers and protection. Left-hand forces were out to get her. "They want me dead," she would say. She used to write her enemies' names down on tiny slips of paper and freeze them into ice cubes in a curse. She had a chapel built in the Dandenongs and named it Santiniketan Lodge. Santiniketan Lodge? Rainer's old house is across the road, and the brown brick lodge is still there on prime real estate next to protected forest that is owned by a trust on Hamilton Byrne's behalf. This was where she would give her sermons or discourses. One day, Rosie and I were let in. It was both a privilege and a shock to be there. It's one thing to read files and listen to tapes and talk to people about their memories, but to be inside this place, even if it had fallen into disuse, was confronting. The lodge cemented the cult and gave it focus. It was where members were given instructions as a group to follow Hamilton Byrne and Hamilton Byrne only. It was there they were told the up-top children were being protected. It was here they were asked to turn their back on society and suspend disbelief. Heavy orange curtains were drawn tight that day, and the power was off, but Anne's special purple chair was still up front, dwarfed by a crucifix on the wall. An old order of service showed that Handel's Largo was played as she entered the lodge, bathed in blue light after group meditation. Every cult member was ordered to create a blue room with a picture of her at their homes to worship in. At the Colts Peak, there were more than 200 cars parked outside the lodge, shoes lined up in the entrance. Hamilton Byrne was taking money from her followers and also acquiring property in the Dandenongs from them. "It started the group," she said. "I had to start it. That was divine orders." "That was the divine vision. You are the one being rescued." That's what she said. "I love children." That's another quote. Now, as she approaches the death she always said she could cheat, a small band of mostly aging supporters look after her affairs and visit her in the nursing home. One does her washing. All are preparing to find out whether they will benefit from her significant estate. Yet, as Stevenson Helmer told us over lunch one day in the Dandenongs, people will say your guru is dead, and that will be true, but the lineage doesn't cut out. There will always be a great white brotherhood on this planet. Always. It's ridiculous. So, yeah, I just wanted to read a little bit about that. Pretty interesting. And I believe some people were saying Julian Assange came from here. I don't know, though. And this cult is called a Nazi cult all over the truth, you know, movement. It's ridiculous. They even compare it to the whole Lebensborn thing, which is just so stupid. I think this is Henry Mackow, who's a Jew anyways, right? But the whole Lebensborn thing was not like some place like a whorehouse, basically, where like SS officers would go in and impregnate random women. It's my understanding that the whole Lebensborn program was like maternity care for mothers, or mothers who maybe didn't have a father for the baby, or things like that. Someone did an article about it on the Tribune years ago, but we're always, you know, shown that it's like this breeding program. All right, so moving on to one last topic. Well, we'll see if it takes me 15 minutes to talk about it. I don't know, but I was so desperate for something to listen to while I was making products today, so I threw on a show on Greg Carlstein, or Carl Wood, on his, the Higher Side Chats thing. And he had this guest on named Eileen Day McCusick. And, some of what she was saying was interesting. I guess she does tuning the human biofield and uses tuning forks and stuff like that. And there is something to that. It's definitely interesting. But then I heard this weird video from her, and I want to play it for you guys because it's very strange. I don't really know what she's getting at here, but let's listen to it.
Something that I would really love to get your feedback on, and that is my upcoming TEDx talk. So I've been wanting to do one of these for a long time, and one of the reasons why I haven't, well, there's lots of reasons. I've been really busy teaching, but as of July, I am retiring from
my... Okay, sorry, let me get to the actual topic here, which is white men. Okay.
But what's been coming to me lately, kind of in weird ways, like even an episode of The Twilight Zone spoke to it. It just has been coming in this cluster about the emotion of hate. So In battlefield tuning, there's two emotions I've found that people don't like to talk about and don't like to own, don't like to like feel, really. One of them is shame. And Brené Brown has done a fabulous job in getting people to recognize and to talk about shame. But nobody's talking about hate. And the first thought I had around this was about writing an article titled, White Men, Please Stop Hating Yourselves.
Okay, that sounds nice, right? I mean, white men should not hate themselves for being white men, but how she explains, you know, why they feel self-hatred is interesting, so I'll let it play.
Because I think so many of the problems we have in the world comes from the self-loathing of white males.
Wait, what? Wait, hold on. So all of the bad shit in the world is because, I mean, okay, maybe. Like, yeah, they've been programmed not to love themselves or not to think highly of themselves. Therefore, they stand by and let evil happen. Okay, I could maybe go with that. But to me, it just seems like there's just blame being put on white men because they just randomly started hating themselves. It just came out of nowhere. And because they just hate themselves and they don't want to acknowledge that, the world is just a terrible place. I mean, what is this supposed to mean? I'll let her keep going.
I mean, don't get me wrong. It's an airplane going over. I'm about to get a new studio where that won't be a problem. But I'm in the flight path of Burlington Airport and close by, which is good because I fly a lot. Hate. So I'm just going to, white men hating. I know everybody, to some degree, hates themselves. And we, right, take a breath around that one. And we may think that we hate others. You know, we may think that we hate certain politicians or people in our life who are assholes or narcissists, and it's easy to hate them, but they really hate themselves. You know, the narcissistic personality, I would also call an asshole, pardon my profanity. And I coined a phrase a while back that everyone needs an asshole in their life to help them work their shit out.
Really? Really? So we need assholes and narcissists. You know, this is like some Tony Robbins crap. Like, thanks for abusing me, Mom. I'm much stronger now because of that. I don't know. She's pictured in front of some awful modern art monstrosity as well. It's just very ugly and I don't know. Okay, I'll play a little bit more, and then I want to get into something weird I found in her books.
Because those kinds of characters who are so full of self-loathing, they just emanate hate. And if you hate yourself
Remember that. White men hate themselves, so they emanate hate.
On any level, in any place, you're going to stick around in the path of that. Because all they're doing is reflecting a voice in your own head. It's an outer reflection of an inner experience. And people who really, truly understand and surrender to self-love have the self-respect and also the self-knowing and flowing to not be in the pathway, ideally, of those kinds of characters, you know? And once you've worked your shit out, you don't really need assholes in your life, so they don't tend to hang out. So, so really, hate is, it's an issue for all of us, and we're taught when we're young that hate is really bad, like, especially women. And if you say, like, I hate cherry ice cream, they're like, oh, no, like, hate's a strong word, like, don't use that word, like, hate is bad. And so we end up kind of walling off our awareness of it. We're still experiencing it, but it's not coming up into cognition. You know, we've got this thing in the back of our neck, at the base of the neck, that I call the gatekeeper. And the gatekeeper is like a bouncer at an exclusive club, and he only lets in, you know, the acceptable people, the right crowd. And things like hate and rage and shame and jealousy and, you know, all of those emotions that we call bad or negative, you know, aren't allowed in. So it doesn't mean that they aren't being generated, because emotions being generated is a normal function of the human body and part of what directs us in life and helps keep us, you know, healthy, emotionally healthy. Otherwise, we'd be like lepers. You know, we need to have these places of pain so we experience them. I feel like emotions, in a way, are kind of like the zip strips in a highway. You know, you start drifting off in the breakdown lane and you go into so, you know, these emotions are kind of like that, and but they're guidance posts to the, you know, you've gone into the rough and how do you need to adjust to come back into neutral, back into your flow.
Okay, I mean, like, some of this is interesting, but I just don't understand the whole white male part. Even people in the comments are saying, nix the white male bit. That will put off an already persecuted demographic. Yeah. Okay. It's just really weird. So then found this. I guess it's an excerpt from one of her books. Let's see. Let's see if I can find it. Yahweh. Okay. So someone in this forum says, I'm in chapter 3, how sound balancing came to be now, and I just came to this. This is from her book. Although I had been using a weighted C128 fork occasionally for a few years, mostly by placing the handle on shoulder knots in 2010, I acquired a weighted 26 hertz fork. This fork is the lowest frequency fork that can be manufactured, and though somewhat large and unwieldy, the penetrating qualities of the very low frequency have shown themselves to be very beneficial, with people reporting feeling very relaxed after the tone has been applied to the body. The fork is imprinted with the letters YHVH, which is Hebrew for the name of the Creator. I am who I am. Through Hebrew gematria, a system of assigning a numerical value to a word or phrase, the value of the name Yahweh, Yod, He, Vav, He, is 10 plus 5 plus 6 plus 5, which equals 26. The Tetragrammatron, one of the names of God in the Hebrew Bible. Hence, I have nicknamed it the G/D fork. So she won't even say God. Is she a Jewess? I mean, she doesn't look like one, but... what is this? I just thought that was really weird. So she's got her Yahweh tuning fork that she's healing people with. Makes sense. Is she healing all the white men from their self-hatred that is then ruining the world? So I just thought that was odd. But the whole tuning fork thing is interesting, and it makes sense. I mean, we are vibration and frequency, so it is definitely interesting. If I had money, I would totally buy myself some. Tuning forks. I could use all the freaking stress relief I can get. That is for sure. Just another thing that I found a little bit off-putting was that she claims she can do this like sound healing remotely, like over the computer. And I just don't buy that. Like, why don't I just then play these frequencies myself? I don't need to pay you to like play your forks. Why don't I just do it myself? It just seems kind of like, you know, these energy healer guys, like that Dr. Scott from Heaven's Harmonies that Bita Benoit was working with. And, you know, he's like, oh, well, I could change your life for the small fee of $100 for a Skype call, and I'll just energy heal you over Skype. It just, I don't know. And I guess she's getting ready for a TED talk. So, you know, she's officially made it. She can talk about white men on the TEDx stage. All right, well, for the remaining few minutes, I'll just let her finish up her little talk here and see if we can make any more sense of it, because I just don't get it.
So emotions are really useful, and all emotions are useful, and we don't want to look at any of them or bad or wrong. Like, everybody's welcome in the club. Everybody's welcome at the table. Because everything plays a role in keeping us safe and healthy and sane.
I agree with that, yeah. And hate shouldn't be like this taboo thing that we're not allowed to feel. But again, I just don't understand why it was focusing on white males.
And so if we deny the awareness of hate or the expression of hate, it festers. And where it actually piles up is on our physical heart itself. So every time somebody feels hate, it's like a film that settles on the physical heart.
Oh, bad, bad, bad. We're getting film on our hearts for hating, you guys. Look, obviously you shouldn't go around hating everything. Like, you don't want to just be angry all the time, but hate is legitimate. It's because you hate what threatens what you love. That's pretty simple.
And over time and reinforcement, what happens is these films harden and get heavy and thick, The term someone being black-hearted is because it's layered up. But not only that, what it does is it hate arrests love. It inhibits love, right?
Does it, though? Because how can you love something if you don't hate what threatens what you love? I don't think you can just live in a world where you just love, love, love and don't hate anything. I mean, just seems kind of new agey to me.
Is love. The electricity that powers your heart is love. And, you know,
is it really love, though? I think it's just electricity. Like, I don't think you're like, oh, that electricity is love. It just sounds airy-fairy.
If your heart stops, what do? Start it back up again with electricity. It's an
No, they start it back up with love, okay? That's what you just said.
The same electricity that is in your wall is in your body and is in the environment, in lightning and northern lights and the sun and the plasma of space, right? It's all the same electricity that is like the energy of life that powers everything. So when we feel hate, we are inhibiting.
My God, another plane.
That.
Oh, this is cool. For $20, I can heal my hate. Once purchased, you can access, download this audio file via Access Your Digital Content. Before you say, oh, this one is not for me, I don't hate anyone or anything, I would invite you to read more. Many of us have self-hatred, blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, okay. Well, I am going to end this for the night. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Please check out heathenherbs.com. We have organic pumpkin butter that is available for purchase. We have hibiscus and American Beauty berry syrup for purchase. I just made a batch of citrus soap. So it has orange peel powder in there and calendula flowers, orange and grapefruit essential oils. So those will be ready in like a week or two. They have to cure. So yeah, and I'm going to be dabbling in shampoo bars soon. I just need to order more stuff and that costs money. So I got to save up. But thank you to everybody who has supported Heathen Herbs. Please go and check out our great sale that we have going on. If you spend you spend $50, you get $10 off or something. Yeah, there's money off. So, you know, go check it out. We're going to run that sale up until Samhain, November 1st. And yeah, it'll be a great way to stock up on stuff that you might need for the winter, like your magnesium, iodine, elderberry, echinacea, colloidal silver. And the echinacea tincture now has licorice root added in there as well, which is super awesome for the immune system. So check that out. We also might start making some lozenges for the fun winter season we have ahead where everybody gets sick and they can't breathe and all that fun stuff. So thanks for listening, guys. I love you all. You're amazing. Thank you for sticking with us through all these years. I think Kyle and I will probably be back this Sunday to finish up our little story. Might even take a few more shows. We got a lot of stories. But that's it. Thanks for listening, guys. Good night.
I arrive at the